Hebrews chapter 11. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their commendation. By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists, and that he rewards those who seek him. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. By faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. By faith, Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born descendants, as many as the stars of heaven, and as many as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country. That is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, "Through Isaac shall your offspring be named." He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the head of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave directions concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that the child was beautiful, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and sprinkled the blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn might not touch them. By faith the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. What more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel and the prophets, whom through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with a sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and in caves of the earth. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect. Let's pray. Thank you, Lord, for this better thing that you did send, and as you promised, you sent a Savior to come and make all things right, to destroy the hold of evil in the world, and to give the power to your people, to your sons, to overcome and to show the world what truth is and to change the world for you. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so we're going to be finishing Genesis 12 today. Took a big chunk. Hang on tight. Hang on, Suki. Suki, hang on. Got some audio visuals today. Y'all been able to listen to any of the past weeks that we've done? Okay. Well, I'm not going to be able to catch you up, probably, that, but we are at Genesis chapter 12. And if I could quickly review. Genesis 10 was the descendants of Noah. Genesis 11 was Tower of Babel. Tower of Babel occurs, the division of the nations. We have the Shem's descendants. And we get to Terah, one of Shem's descendants. Terah, father and Abram. And let's see here. Living in Ur of the Chaldeans. Terah took Abram, who was his son, and Lot, and his rest of the family, and they traveled and settled in Haran. So they're currently in Haran. However, the days of Terah were 205 years. Terah died in Haran. That's where chapter 12 starts at this point. It says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house, and I'll make you a great nation." And we stopped in verse 3, so we're starting in verse 4 today, of chapter 12 of Genesis. And the rest of chapter 12 has three parts to it. We're going to... Part one is about Abram leaving Haran and traveling to Canaan and receiving the promise there, receiving a promise of the land. And secondly, he's going to... move to a new location and build an altar. And lastly, he's going to have to travel to Egypt because of a famine. We're going to have an episode that happens there. So to begin, verse 4 says, I'm not anywhere close to verse 4. I'll just read this. So departed Abram, as had spoken to him Yahweh, and went with him Lot. And Abraham was old, 75 years of age, and departed. And when he departed from Haran, and he took Abram, Sarah his wife, Lot the son of his brother, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they acquired. People whom they acquired in Haran. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. So, as we said, end of chapter 11, Terah dies. And it doesn't necessarily mean that Terah was already deceased when Abram left, but it kind of reads that way. Abram departed, it says, as Yahweh had instructed, as God had instructed. So we have our New Testament references that talk about Abraham being called out of Ur. If we just limit ourselves to what we read here, it sounds as if Abraham is in Terah when he's called. So maybe there were. Maybe there were two times. Maybe God told him in Ur, I want y'all to go to Canaan. And then here he has a more direct call. Okay, it's time to leave Haran and go to Canaan.
Can you turn off the lights? Thank you.
So, the most important part of this is that Abram obeyed. Abram obeyed when God called him to do something. And here he calls him to leave and go to Canaan. He takes Lot with him. There's speculation that Lot was maybe an orphan at this time. He's not orphan in the sense of a little orphan, Annie or whatever, but he's a grown man, but in the sense, well, he's not a grown man. He's an adult, young adult, likely, but he's going with Abram because that's the only family he has left. It's a speculation. We're not told that here. But like I said, the main point is Yahweh says, go. Abram obeys. The other point here, Abram, it says, is 75 years old when he leaves Haran. Now, at this point, I think, so in all the little books that have pictures in them, you see Abram traveling out to the promised land, and he's not quite decrepit yet, but he's got big, long, huge beard, and he's old, or he's at least very mature in most of the pictures I see, because he's 75 years old. But see, the thing I feel like you have to recognize is that Abraham lived to be 175 years old. And I just can't hardly believe that he just has this, whoop, when he's 50 years old or 70 years old, he looks like we do when we're 50 or 75. And then for 100 years, he stays old and decrepit. That's just not, I don't think how that would have worked. I think it would have worked like a gradual aging just like we do. It just took longer to hit the different age stages. So I did some calculations, and if you take 175 and you calculate that against, let's say, an 80-year lifespan, 90-ish, somewhere around there, basically, when it says he was 75 when he left, that's more like being 35 to 40. And, as related to how we would consider ages and what you think about when you think of. So he's a relatively young man at this point still. Not a teenager or anything, but he's not. I think we have the wrong picture in our head if we picture him as a typical 75-year-old fella. We're going to look at some maps in a minute. We're going to see this is not in some insignificant journey he's taken. This isn't like going to Tuscaloosa or going to Birmingham. This is a significant journey he's going on. All right, verse 5 says he took everything. He took everything, he took everybody, he took all his possessions and left. So what this should tell us is that he wasn't planning to come back. This was an extended vacation. There were no contingency plans. If this doesn't work out, we'll just, we'll leave a little stuff here and we can always return back to where we were. This was we're out of here, and it's like Cortez burning his ships. So he had left, he took everything and everybody. Specifically says going to the land of Canaan. And like I said, I got some maps for you. So, this is our map here, and we have Haran at the top, and the blue line what's the blue line? It's Jacob. The red line is Abraham's journey there. So, it's not like he just walked down the road. He's taking a major travel event here. Probably has a humongous caravan, etc. And verse 6. And passed through Abram, the land, to the place of Shechem. as far as the terebinth tree of Moreh, or Marah. And the Canaanites and the Canaanite were at that time in the land. All right, so if we go back to our map right quick. Shechem is down here. See Shechem? Shechem is where he went to.
Does it have Haran on that map?
Yeah, at the top.
Very top. So he goes from
Haran?
Before Haran, where would this Chaldea be?
Ur's down here.
Okay, so he goes up there.
Big desert right there. So, you know, with his father and his father, you know, whatever family, they all went up to Haran. All right, so he went to Shechem, it says. Let's see what my notes say here. Oh, yeah, here we go. Another map for you. Shechem, again, now we're zooming in on Shechem. You can see where Shechem, we're going to Mount Ebal, Mount Gerizim, remember those? Right there in the valley, probably between, right close there, Shechem. Okay, we'll come back to this map here in a minute, probably. So he travels to Shechem. So I find it interesting. He says he went to the land of Canaan, and then there's a special point that's made here. It says, and the Canaanites were in the land. Okay, so this wasn't just like he's going to the land of the land of Canaan, but the Canaanites aren't there anymore, and there's nobody there. Like, they're there. They're possessing the land. And this is going to be important about what God promises him in just a minute. But he points out that the Canaanites were in the land. And if we remember, the Canaanites were the descendants of Cain. And we remember how what happened with Cain's, what happened to produce Cain with that, the sin of Ham and Noah's wife, etc. So Cain and Canaan was who Noah cursed. And so these are the descendants of Canaan. The Canaanites. All right. Now, I want to talk about the terebinth tree of Moreh, or the oak of Moreh, or Morah. And every time I see this word Morah, I want to think of the place in Middle Earth, Moriah. That's Morah. KJV's got the plains of Moreh, right?
Yeah.
Right. So the word is, the word means large tree. The word for is translated terebinth or oaks. And I think the reason why it's sometimes translated plain is because it's assumed it's like a forest, so it's a flat spot, even though forests grow on the side of mountains too. So I didn't look completely into why KJV had plain, but it means large trees or large tree. So there's multiple places within the Bible where we have this word, the large tree word. So we're in 12, and then in the next chapter we're going to read about the oaks of Mamre, and in Genesis 18. Again, we have the oak of Mamre, and specifically in Genesis 18, it's going to say that Yahweh appears to Abram there. If I remember correctly, this is when the three men come before the destruction of Sodom. Is that the oaks of Mamre? But I could be wrong about that. Okay. In Deuteronomy 11, we actually have Morah again mentioned. It says it's near Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. So going back to our map, here we go. Shechem's right there. Oaks of Morah are there as well. The oak or whatever, if it's one or multiple. In Judges, you have the oak of Zananimim. In Judges 9, you have the You have it refers to the oak of the pillar at Shechem. And so that's likely the same situation, the same spot, because we're talking about Shechem again, talking about this oak there. That's the story of when I can't remember. We just read it in family worship not too long ago. Abimelech, maybe? Is that the name of the? Anyway, no. Anyway, now I gotta look it up, because it actually has a little bit of pertinence in just a minute when we get to it. Abimelech, son of Jerubbaal. Jerubbaal was. I am in Judges. Yeah, Judges. Did I say? What did I say?
No, I'm just tracking.
Oh, yeah, Judges. Right. Judges 9. Jerubbaal was the name for Gideon. So, Abimelech. This is where he goes to Shechem and says, "Hey, who do you want to be ruled by, me or the son of Jerubbaal?" That whole story plays out, and it's verse 6. And all the leaders of Shechem came together at Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar at Shechem. So this was a set apart kind of place. So started getting that vibe in your head. This is not just a big tree, but it's more like a place of this is set apart for different things, like special ceremonies and stuff. Like this was a special ceremony.
Does it go back to Genesis when Jacob buries the idol under the oak of Shechem? In Shechem.
What chapter is that?
That is Genesis 35.
It could be, yeah, because I didn't. That one didn't make it to my list. And specifically in Judges 9, later in the chapter, in verse 37, it says, somebody's talking here, and it says, look, people are coming down from the center of the land. One company is coming from the direction of the diviner's oak. Or a diviner would be like a conjurer type situation. Someone who is like a sagey kind of situation. So assuming it's still in the same context, same area as all this is going on, it may be talking about the same place. Maybe another oak somewhere else. But the point is, even if it's another oak somewhere else, these big trees, these big, either maybe even a grove of trees, are utilized as places of going to for ceremonial purposes, etc. In 1 Samuel 10, there's an oak of Tabor. And here's Samuel anointing Saul, actually. So again, same theme going through here. So, so the word morah actually means teacher or instructor. So you could literally say these were the trees of instruction. I mean, this should be starting to give you a vibe about what these places were. These places were where people went to try to get information, try to get instruction, to try to get knowledge. Okay? And so in the context of the Canaanites and their idolatry and their, you know, false worship of false gods, then this would be where they went to inquire the gods, so to speak. And we all, you know, it should remind you of the idea of the watchers and the information, the knowledge of good and evil and that sort of thing. So this is where Abram, this is where he goes to and he stops. He goes to Shechem, as far as the oak of Morah, or the terebinth tree of Morah. Okay. So this is where he is. That's, you need to know where he is, and you need to know what's significant about where he is. In fact, I would say that the more I study, the more I read, if the Bible tells you, like, what's going on, like, where something happens, or if it says they were so many miles from the boundary of this river and the boundary of this land, you should place some thought into that. It's likely giving you some clues about important things that are happening, especially if you consider from the aspect of cosmic geography. Okay, so here we are. He went to this place, and this is where he is. And then verse 7 happens. Verse 7.
What is cosmic geography?
Well, that's just a nugget we'll get into later. I don't have time to explain all that right now. Briefly, it's the idea behind Babel, where the nations were divided, and so the nations are geographically assigned by God. And so they were assigned their own gods. So each, and then there's more to it than that. You got the story of the what's the dude who came down to see Elisha, and then he who had leprosy, and then
Naaman,
right? And then when he gets ready to go, he says, "Can I take some dirt back with me?" So he literally wants to take the geography of where this God who healed him reigns. So that's sort of behind cosmic geography. You forced me into it. So verse 7. So at this place of where people went to inquire of the gods, it says, "And appeared Yahweh to Abram and said, I will give to your descendants, I will give this land. And he built there an altar to Yahweh who appeared to him. And he moved from there." Okay, let's stop at 7. Let's stop at 8. Okay. So, at this place where people went to meet the gods, what happens? The Most High God comes and speaks to Abram. And he says, and he appeared. This means to make visible or to cause to be able to be perceived. Okay. And it wasn't a messenger from Yahweh. It says, and Yahweh appeared to him, not a messenger, and spoke to Abram, and what he said was a promise. It says, his promise is that, he says, look around, right? Now, here's another map. Now, let's go back to this one. Where is Shechem, right? Where is Shechem? Here's Bethel for reference, just because the next map doesn't have Shechem on it, but it has Bethel on it. See, here's Bethel, so Shechem would have been just a little north of there on the A, just sort of in that general area. So this is a modern map. So you can take your modern, as you think about Israel in modern times. So I found it quite interesting that Abram is standing in the middle of the West Bank, which was currently Palestinian right now, right, in control of it. In the West Bank? I think it is. And so he's standing there, and God says, what's he say to him? Look all around you. All this is going to be given to you. That's his promise. Of course, he can't physically see all the way down, this far with his physical eyes. Unless God miraculously gave him the ability to do it, he didn't quite see, like, literally all that. But God says to him, look around, and I will give this land to you. So this is sort of the first thing that happens in our chapter here, is God making the promise to Abram. And I find it quite interesting because, to remind you, and I'll read it again, he passed through as far as the tree of Moriah with the Canaanites in the land. He's standing there in the middle of the Canaanites, and Yahweh appears to him and says, I'll give you this land. And then it says, and he built there an altar to Yahweh, who had appeared to him. So you don't need to miss the significance of this. Abram comes into to enemy territory. Territory claimed and run and dominated by the enemies of God. And he goes to the enemy's worship area. And God comes to him and says, all this is going to be yours. And I'm your God, so that means by default, all this this is going to be mine. This is all mine anyway. I'm going to give it to you, and I'm going to tell you this in the face of all these gods, where people here like to go and worship and get information. Right here, I'm going to make this, and then Abram builds an altar to the one true God there. I don't think we should pass over that too lightly. Any questions? So there in the middle of the grove, Abram calls on the name of Yahweh. He builds an altar. I thought for a minute I would just run through. That's interesting. I was trying to remember. I was like, well, how many more altars have been built before now? Or at least we hear about it in the scriptures. And so then I got to looking, and basically, so I got a list for you. So far, the only altar that's been built is Noah, who built an altar after the flood. So building of altars, biblically speaking, is post-flood. Not saying it didn't happen, but we don't have any record of it happening before the flood. Noah built an altar. And what did he do with the altar?
Sacrificed animals on it.
He did. He sacrificed. And what happened, this was after the flood, he sacrifices as a thanksgiving, right? As a thank you. So here we have Abram, and after the promise, he builds an altar. Later, he's going to build an altar again, it says, and this is going to be to sacrifice Isaac. Jacob, after a dream, builds his altar. This is the next altar that's built in the biblically. I have a note here, but I can't read it. Moses builds an altar after the Amalekite victory. And he also builds an altar to offer sacrifices at Mount Sinai. And again, there's an altar associated with the tabernacle that's built. Both of those are for sacrifices. Gideon builds an altar after his encounter with a divine messenger. Samuel builds an altar after a Philistine victory. David builds an altar after God stops the plague. And then he offers sacrifices on the altar he builds at Mount Moriah. Same altar, I think, by the way. And Elijah builds an altar on top of Mount Carmel to offer sacrifices there. So you see a little theme going. Altars are built either after a significant event in reverence and worship to God, or they're built to make a sacrifice on. Sometimes it's the same event, but every time it's talked about, it'll say he kind of separates them a little bit, even if they curve really close together, and it's like the David event where he built the altar there, but because of the plague. So, what about today? Do we have altars today? We actually do have an altar. The New Jerusalem has an altar. And the scriptures define the New Jerusalem as the church. But we have no altar of sacrifice anymore because that was completed at the cross. In Hebrews 13, y'all remember Hebrews when we went through Hebrews. Hebrews 13 is speaking of priests. Remember, this is before AD 70, so the temple is still standing. Sacrifices, the priests are still functioning in the temple. I'm not sure if the sacrifices are still happening. But the priests are still functioning in the temple. And they're referring to the priest. Hebrews 13 is talking about they have, I should probably just look it up. I didn't write down the actual number of the verse. I just wrote the chapter down. I think it's 13.
13 verse 10.
That's it. We have an altar from which those who serve the tent or the tabernacle, or in this case it would be like the temple, have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought to the holy places by the high priest as a sacrifice for sin are burned outside the camp. So this is a throwback, remembering back to the temple sacrifices and the tabernacle sacrifices. But the point here is that we do have an altar. And then the context here would be that the altar that we have is the partaking of the Lord's Supper. It's a example. It's a metaphor of the sacrifice. It's remembrance of Christ's sacrifice on the cross. So when it says we eat at Christ. Is that what it says? Yeah, it says they don't have a right to eat, which means that. So it says we have an altar from which they don't have a right to eat, which means we have an altar that we have a right to eat at. And when we eat, basically, literally in the Old Testament, they took the animals and the grain offerings and the wine offerings and the oil, and they took them as offerings, and they sacrificed. And part of the offering, part of the sacrifice, was literally used to have a feast with. So they literally ate from the altar in the Old Covenant system, in the Old Testament system. So just like the whole rest of the book of Hebrews, which was one big, that was then, that was a type and shadow, that was less significant, that was just an image, a metaphor, a literal metaphor of what is now a superior situation. That was the whole book of Hebrews. Exactly the same here. They literally did that, and yet in that we have now even better situation, because we eat from the altar of the sacrifice of Christ. We it's a metaphor that we eat. We do eat in the Lord's Supper, but the eating that's talking about here is we are nourished from the altar of Christ. So it becomes not literal anymore, but completely accomplished. And it's a big metaphor. To say it's a metaphor, I don't want to take away from the significance of it. You got
the reality.
Yeah, I don't want to take away from that. To say it's now a metaphor doesn't take anything away from it. It's better now. It's spiritual. So we do have an altar. The altar is we talked about the New Jerusalem. It says there's an altar there. The altar is the church, and what we do at the altar is we worship. Part of what they did too, because all these altars that were built after the fact of something were altars built in thanksgiving and worship to Yahweh, who did something for them. Every one of these cases. So, altars are significant. Abraham built an altar, and I don't think it's insignificant that he built it in the face of the enemies and said, Yahweh says, this is mine. Questions or comments before I move on to the next part? Verse 8, and he moved from there to the mountain east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east, and he built there an altar to Yahweh. So, see, this is where I almost got confused, because he builds two altars. He built there an altar when he was at the grove, and now he's going to go pitch his tents and build another altar. Okay? And what he's going to do here, when he builds this altar, he's going to actually call the name of Yahweh, so he's going to worship. Now, I got you a little video here. I don't know how loud this is going to be. I'll try not to blast your ears. Not loud at all, is it? How do I get sound?
Bottom right, the first icon.
Should be good. I can hear it buzzing. Generally, it buzzes when he's connected it. I think you should hear it now.
Oh, you got it?
Been filled back in, but there's no...
Let me back it up 10 seconds.
Feet, it's already been excavated, but it's been filled back in. But there's no question about it. This is the ancient city of Bethel.
So once I understood where ancient Bethel was located, where it had been excavated, then to find the biblical city of Ai is really easy, because the Bible describes, as we'll see in a minute, it describes these two cities close to each other and directly east and west of each other. So if this is Bethel, then all you have to do is go a little ways to the east and you'll come to the ancient mound, the Tell of Ai. Therefore, on top of the ruins of Bethel is the town of Beitin, and on a high ridge to the east are the ruins of an early Christian church. Going further east, we come to the ancient mound of the ruins of the biblical city of Ai.
So now that we know that the Bronze Age city that is just to the west of this church ruin is Bethel, and that the Bronze Age city that is just to the east of these church ruins is biblical Ai, now we can just use the Bible to understand what this site commemorates. The key verse is Genesis 12, verse 8, which says, "From there he, that is Abram, went on toward the hills east of Bethel." That's where I'm standing right now, is on top of a hill east of Bethel, "and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord." This is the ancient campsite of Abraham, where he built an altar and called on the name of Yahweh. How can we know where Abraham pitched his tent thousands and thousands of years after he camped here? We know because the Bible gives us a description in between these two fortified Bronze Age cities. And since we know where these fortified Bronze Age cities are, and there's only one archaeological site in between them, which is closer to Bethel than it is to Ai, then it becomes obvious that what this site is commemorating is the ancient campsite of the patriarchs.
In Genesis chapter 13,
let's see, I think that's as far as we were going to go. No, a little bit more.
Read of Abram. From the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier, and where he'd first built an altar. There Abram called on the name of the Lord. The Lord said to Abram, "Look around from where you are, to the north and south, to the east and west. All the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth. So if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring could be counted. Go walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you."
Okay, so I thought that was pretty cool. What was really worth one more looking at here is this flyover that they did with a drone.
I. Therefore, on top of the ruins of Bethel is the town of Betin, and on a high ridge to the east
are
the ruins of an early Christian church. Going further east, we come to the ancient mound of the ruins of the biblical city of Ai.
It didn't seem that far to us. I mean, for them, they had to walk over the hills and stuff. It would have been some travel time. But anyway, I just thought that was pretty neat how they did the drone. And you could basically, it looks like you could probably drive that in an hour or two, maybe, or less. From there to there. Maybe that far. And then, yet there were two cities. Another thing is, here's a building. Here, presumably, is the whole city of Ai. When they talked about a city, it's just not the scale that we're used to for what a city is. It's more like a little town. But that was the city of Ai and the city of Bethel. And when they talk about going and laying siege to a city, They were varying sizes, but I'm sure their houses were smaller too, though. All right, well, thought that would be good. So that's where he is now. He left and he's now pitched his tent. He has called on the name of Yahweh, has built an altar and called on the name of Yahweh. So he's worship. He's there and he's pitched his tent, which I presume he's going to stay there for a little while, if he pitches his tent. And so he builds an altar there, calls on the name of Yahweh. Any questions? That's sort of part two here. Okay, verse 9 then. So journeyed Abram, going on and still toward the Negev. Now there was a famine in the land, and went down Abram to Egypt to dwell there. For severe was the famine in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "Behold, now I know that a woman, beautiful of countenance you are. Therefore it will come to pass, when see you the Egyptians, they will say, his wife, that they will say, his wife this is, and they will kill me, but you they will let live. Say, please, you are my sister. You are, that it may be well with me for your sake, that may live my soul because of you." All right, so the Negev, if we went back to our map, I think it's on there. Nope, it's not on there. It's actually this kind of this bottom corner area down here, Negev. So they're heading toward Egypt, and Abram makes a little bit of a decision here. So they're getting close to Egypt, and he becomes concerned of what might happen when they get there. And he asked Sarah to say she's his sister. Now we learn in Genesis 20:12 that Sarah was his sister, but his half sister. That's one thing to note. Now, the other thing is that Okay, so what I try to do with my with the boys and the girls is to help them understand what beauty is. That beauty is more than just external beauty. There's internal parts to that and everything. So, you know, there's Miss Ruth, you're a beautiful woman.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. Just like my wife is a beautiful woman. And my daughter is a beautiful woman. They're all beautiful. However, I mean, not however. In this context, when it talks about Sarah being beautiful, it is talking about physical beauty. And one of the reasons we know that is because of what happens later and what Abram's worried about in the situation. And what happens later is, you know, they respond exactly like Abram thought they would. The princes of Egypt and the Pharaoh respond just as well. And what they desire is to add Sarah to their houses as a wife. Okay? And so, basically add her to his harem. And just like with Esther, the king went around looking for what? The most beautiful woman in the land to add to his harem. Okay? So that's the context. So what we're talking about here is physical beauty, although there is more to beauty than just physicalness. But in this case, these people don't know Sarah. All they know is what they see. And what they see is enough to desire her. Now, just take a moment. Let's consider the situation. It says later that Sarah is 10 years younger than Abram. And that he left Haran at 75 years of age. Now, that was a long way to travel. I don't know how long it took him. I dare say it took him more than a month or two. Let's just say it took him only a year. Maybe it took him 2 years, though. We're still within the range of, we're only within a few years of 75 at this point. But we're on the other side of 75. We're heading toward 80 for Abram. As far as the numbers in the Bible go, the numbers here in the Bible. So that means Sarah is 75 heading toward, she's 65 heading toward 70. Not generally the age as far as like, as we look at our aging, this is not generally the age where women were chosen to be part of a harem. Let's just put it that way. So I think this is another indication that we need to look at these ages relative to what was going on with their lifespans. And if we do that, Sarah is in her late 20s, age-wise. Like aging wise. Now she doesn't live as long as Abram does, but if Abram's lifespan is a typical lifespan, just because she dies early doesn't mean that it means she's still on the same trajectory aging wise. Okay? So I thought that was very interesting, and so because like this doesn't make a lot of sense if she's aging at the same rate as we age, for her to be in this position of being desired for a harem of a pharaoh. So to me, that adds more credence to that too. And very interesting as you look at these things and you come along these verses where it's like, really, why does it say that? If you dig deep enough, you'll find an answer. So. What happens? Exactly what Abram predicted. They enter the land. The princes, that means like the little, you know, Pharaoh being the head guy, and he has his princes who are in charge of different areas of his territory. Princes, they're coming through the territory, so they haven't quite got down to the capital area or whatever. But the report coming in is, ho-ho, we got this. Now remember, Abram is a wealthy man. He's got... He says, what's he bring? He brings all of his stuff and his people that he acquired. He acquired people. That means slaves, probably, as well as possible like hired, you know, just like people who. So in those cultures, those that had wealth and prosperity, you know, they would hire people to help them with their animals or whatever. And people would, if you didn't have a lot, and you could attach yourself to someone who did, that gave you security. It gave you, it's just like, you know, getting a good job at a good corporation or whatever it used to be. So sure enough, they enter, all the princes, they see Sarah, and they're like, they tell them, Pharaoh, hey, look, Pharaoh, you need this. So let's see here. I think I've got ahead of where I read to. Let's just read ahead here. So Abram tells Sarah what he wants her to do, and it says, and saw her, the princess of Pharaoh, and commended her to Pharaoh, and was taking the woman into the house of Pharaoh. So Sarah is taken into the house of Pharaoh. And Abram, he treated well the Pharaoh for her sake. So for the sake of Abram, who he thinks is her brother, and presumably her, I mean, like literally and like truthfully, Abram's father has died. So, you know, the story that's coming out for the Pharaoh is like, yes, she's my sister. We have left Haran. My father is dead. Blah, blah. So now who's the patriarch of the family? Abram is. Who's responsible for the giving away of his sister? Abram is. So Abram is acting in a paternal manner for Sarah here in terms of what the Pharaoh sees going on. So Abram is treated well, just like you would go to your father-in-law or prospective father-in-law and want to treat them well, gain their favor, right? So Abram is treated well by the Pharaoh for Sarah's sake. And it says, and he had sheep and oxen and donkeys and men servants and maid servants and female donkeys and camels. Okay? So Abram gets pretty wealthy because of this, actually. But 17. But plagued Yahweh. So Yahweh sends the plague. Plagued Yahweh Pharaoh with plagues great in his house because of Sarah, the wife of Abram. So God sends a plague to the house of Pharaoh. We don't know what the plague is. Doesn't say exactly what's happening. People might be dying. People might be having, you know, medical conditions, but usually a plague was some sort of medical condition. Might have caused death, might have just caused like a bunch of leprosy or something like that. They would be both considered plagues. It may not have been a medical plague. I mean, sometimes it's used more broadly and it's just bad things were happening, but generally it's a plague. Or like locusts sometimes were considered a plague on the land, but here it's a plague on his house. So something's going on with, and his house is more than just him and his kids and his wife and that sort of thing. His house is everything he owns, his servants, his everything. That's his house. So God sends a plague because of Sarah. And called Pharaoh, this is verse 18, and called Pharaoh Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that your wife she was? Why did you say my sister she is? So I might have taken her to me as a wife. So somehow Pharaoh connects the plague with the plagues going on with the fact that he's brought Sarah into his house. He doesn't tell us how that happens. Now, we'll do a little side skip here. Once I find it. Just to make a mention here. Verses, okay, we're in chapter 12. In chapter 20, there's another story that's very similar to this one. Okay, with Abram and Sarah and another king and him saying, tell him you're my sister. And she gets taken in and everything. In fact, similarities are they both happen in the Negev area. It says, Abram gives Sarah the same instructions, but and they have similar outcomes. The outcomes are very similar, almost, I mean, they're identical. There are some differences, though. You know, one says specifically it's in Egypt. The other is more, it says Gerar. Now, I didn't go to do all the research to see if Gerar is technically in Egypt or whatever, but it says it in Gerar. They could be very close because they're both happening in the region of the Negev. And in this account, which is what I'm trying to get to, I guess, there's no mention of how Pharaoh finds out about Sarah being Abram's wife. But in account in 20, it's more clear that God revealed it to that king. Was that King Abimelech? Yeah, another Abimelech. So some would say that this is the same story told twice. Now you might say, well, how in the world are they going to do that, right? Well, I mean, there are a bunch of similarities, and then the way it would happen is there'll be a school of thought that doesn't deny that the Pentateuch was written by Moses, but they would also say that it was editing done through the years. And some of them would be very conservative and say that, you know, we're happy to say that God was in control of the editing too. But that somebody came along and put this story in, but it was a repeat of the same story. I just throw that out there in case y'all run across it. But there is that other story. But in this case, we're not told how the Pharaoh understands that this is related to Sarah. But somehow he does. And so his response is to basically say, well, he literally says, take your wife back and leave. That's what he says to her. So he says, now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go your way. So commanded concerning him Pharaoh to his men, and they sent away. They sent away him and his wife and all that he had. So interestingly, he's very content to just have this situation done. That's how bad the plague was, apparently. He's like, just go. Kind of like reminiscent of what's going to happen with the Pharaoh later when he tells the people, to, you know, just go, just get out of my land after all the plagues. So you have a little bit of similarity going on there with the upcoming plagues at the time of Moses. So I would point out too as well that he says, I think it's important and relevant here, back to the context, that Pharaoh's concern was, he said, I almost took her as my wife. So he had not yet touched Sarah. He had not yet taken her as his wife. So, but that's what he was most concerned about. He's like, dude, I almost did this. And, you know, I don't know, but it's like, dude, if the plagues were this bad and I hadn't even touched her yet, just think what would have happened if I'd done that. But here we have a situation where that didn't happen. Now, so, what are we to make of this? Because we have to be very careful that we do not place upon this situation our own context, but we leave this in the context of what's going on here and strictly what it says goes on here. I would say we can look at this. We have three ways we can look at it. We can look at it through the actions of Abram, the actions of Sarah, and the actions of God. And we'll do that right quick. First of all, the actions of Abram. I'll be honest with you, when I first read this, my knee-jerk reaction was, well, Abram was afraid. He was afraid of dying. So he came up with this plan that this wouldn't happen. I'm not sure that's the case, though. I think this was more Abram was wise. Abram was aware of the situation. Abram was, he said, you know, he didn't say it literally like this, but, you know, in my world, in this world I live in, I have a lot of wealth, and I have a beautiful wife. And in my world, when I'm about to have to go into this foreign land. I'm in a foreign land now, but I'm going to another foreign land. I have no people. These aren't my people. I have nothing here that makes somebody want to respect me. They don't know me from anybody. They know I'm wealthy because I got all this stuff, but they don't really know me. So there's nothing to, and I'm going in I'm going into their territory. And I have, if you're thinking about it militarily, he has no line of communication. He has no, you know, he's got only what he's got with him. He's going to have to suffice off the land when he gets there. You know, he's on his own. And so he's like, what would I do? You know, against a whole people. I'm just me and my little band. Even though maybe hundreds of people in his band, we're going to find out later, he could muster an army of hundreds to go rescue Lot. That, you know, I don't know if he had all those people now or not, but the point is that he knows what happens. Well, I know what happened when these situations arise. People just take whatever they want. So how can I avoid this? And his solution was to do this, to say this about Sarah. And he was proven right that this was going to happen when he went in. Maybe twice proven that it was going to happen. So I think this was, he understood human nature. He understood the situation. He made a calculated plan to try to avoid, and he also realized that, you know, if they want Sarah because she's beautiful, they're not going to damage her. They would just destroy me to get her. So that was his position. And so he chose, and he did not. And number two, he did not lie. There's still, you're going to see some people out there want to say, well, Abraham lied about Sarah being his sister. Well, he didn't lie. She was his sister. She was his half-sister. So Abram thwarted his enemies while not bearing false witness. But it also is an example of that we're not, you know, we don't require to tell our enemies every little thing. But we have a good example here of Abram did not lie to his enemies. He did not bear false witness. He did not say, he could have said, she's my cousin, or, you know, she's my niece, and I'm her, you know, protector or whatever, and I can give her away in marriage. He didn't say that. He said, he spoke the truth. And I would like to think God rewarded him for that. Now, from actions of Sarah, we don't have anything here in our text that says what Sarah was thinking, what she said, how she felt about the situation, or anything like that. We do have a clue, though, in 1 Peter, where it says that Sarah called Abram Lord. And that's an indication that Sarah was submissive to her husband. And that doesn't mean she was perfect and she had no fear and she had no reservations and she, like, every time anything was said, she was just like, you know, this perfect submissive woman. I kind of doubt that's the situation. But the reality is that ultimately she did do what Abram said to do. And so in doing so, what did we see happen here?
God provided.
God honored her and protected her. She submitted to her husband, as God said to do, and God, the result of that was God honored that and protected her. So because, did God honor that and protect that because, just because she submitted to her husband? In a way, yes, but what she's doing when she submits to her husband is she's submitting to God too. So God is honoring her because she submitted to him, ultimately. It's just that's the way God has ordered and instructed women to show their obedience to him is to obey him in this way, in this manner. So we can see it from Sarah. We can see the actions of Sarah, and we can learn, and we can see that we can see what that she obeyed. She obeyed Abram, and in turn, by doing that, she's obeying God. And lastly, we can see the actions of God, in which God had a plan. His plan was that the seed of Abraham would come through Sarah. And we know that Sarah had not had any children at this point. So she was a barren woman. She was a barren woman. She had not any children. So this child that would come would be her firstborn when it came. And here we have God protecting Sarah from a potential, you know, theoretically a different conception that he had planned. So what he had planned was the conception of Isaac from Abraham through Sarah. And so ultimately we have the actions of God doing two things: preserving the family of Abraham, preserving Abram, and preserving Sarah, and preserving, well, three things, and preserving the future offspring, the future descendant, which was a promise, which was the promise that he had made. So we have the faithfulness of Yahweh shown here in this situation.